Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us. At least it's Thursday evening here when we're recording. You may be listening anywhere in the world at any time on any day, which is very exciting to me and one of the things that really makes me very happy about the show, that there are people all over the place listening. And thank you for being here. Wherever here is and wherever when is. So tonight's guest is Peter Champeau, or Champeau. We were chatting about the spelling and the proper pronunciation, who is somebody I've tried to meet for years. He's an expert in his field, and it's a very unique field, and it's about the power of place and the power of placement. And we will be talking to Peter in just a few minutes after tonight's metaphysical musing. And you've been hearing me chatter, tell stories, whine about the fact that I've been moving. And I'm moved, which is a wonderful thing. And my joke is that I've moved from downtown in my little college town where I was surrounded by students who are often rowdy and drunk to a place which is very, very rural, and the house I'm in is over 200 years old, and I'm in the middle of a field, and we probably will have some uninvited guests like bears or coyotes, but they will not be drunk. So I'm very excited about that. It's absolutely blissful being here, even though my place is still totally a pile of chaotic boxes. But I finally was grounded enough in the place that I decided to walk the land. It's about a 1-acre field. And behind us is a stream and a swamp. And maybe Peter will talk about the other features because I'm in between a very interesting bend in one river and a bend in another river. So this is a little area that's between a small river and a larger river, a lot of water, a lot of wind, which is delightful. I have a breeze all the time. And I went down to the edge of the property, down by the stream, and I walked the edge of the property, and I went down to a corner that was far enough away that I hadn't been there. You have to walk down there intentionally. And there's this little space surrounded by bushes and trees, and in the middle of this is a old spreading tree with many different trunks, and it was clear immediately to me that this was the guardian spirit of the place. And you know, people talk about tree huggers. There are some of us that talk to trees. So I put my hand on the tree and started getting information from the tree. And anybody who's psychic gets their information however you get it. There's actually a psychic method called psychometry where you can take an object that is a personal object of somebody's, you know, their watch or a brooch or something that they wear all the time, and get a whole lot of information about that person because it gets stored in the physical objects. So a living thing like a tree, which has consciousness because everything is consciousness, you can have an interactive conversation. You can listen and have an interaction with them. And I'm always fascinated. When I left my old place, I said goodbye to the trees. I said goodbye to the trees that surrounded my apartment building, and I said goodbye to the trees in the little park and thanked them because I always thank trees. And in the old days, people respected trees in a different way. They were part of life, and people had a sense of their grandeur and how important they were. But most of the trees that we live with have been intentionally placed by people. They're ornamental trees. And so they weren't planted by the seeds of the first tree that was there. There were typically in nature, there's a grandmother tree. It's the first tree from the first seed. And when that tree grows, a grove, and that's how you get a forest, and that's how you get a grove of trees. But most of the trees that are in a rural, in a urban area, have been planted there. They're street trees or they're ornamental trees that somebody planted around their property. And nobody talks to them. So when I go through and I go, hi, how you doing? What's going on? The response I get is gratitude. They are very, very happy that somebody sees them, that somebody is sending them love and appreciation, that somebody can hear them. I know there are some of you out there listening and saying, that's pretty weird. And there are other people nodding their heads and going, I thought I was the only one that did that. So I went down and I talked to the grandfather tree. It's usually a grandmother, so it was interesting to me that this was male energy. And I realized that both from my bedroom and from my office window, where I'm going to be sitting working at my computer, my view out the window, which is framed by the window and looks a whole lot like a painting, is in the distance this grandfather tree, and then behind that some other trees, and then the ridge of a beautiful mountain range that's beyond it. And how wonderful is that? Not only is it a pretty picture, but it's a consciousness that I can communicate with. And I will try and figure out, if my Wi-Fi reaches that far, I will be out there on a folding chair every nice day that we have, just out there in the quiet corner of the property. So, for those of you that never considered contacting the consciousness of trees, trees can help you learn how to ground. Trees can teach you many things about stillness and about connection to the earth. But they also will give you information, and there's a tremendous amount of love and appreciation there. So the other thing, which I was taught by the Cherokee medicine man that I studied with, the Kitawa. The voice of the trees in the physical world is the leaves and leaves rustling. So, in effect, the wind is part of the voice of the trees. And if you have a conversation with them and give them appreciation, what frequently will happen is that the wind will kick up and rustle the leaves, and it will rustle down a grove of trees. Wind will change direction. And the most dramatic thing I had happen with that was a tree that was planted to honor my father, who worked at an institution in Northern California. And when he died, many hundreds of people came to the service. And to honor him, they planted a tree next to the office for the program. And so there was this little sapling. And after the ceremony, I went to go find the tree and thank the tree for holding the honor that they were giving my father, and said, but you don't know who he was. So here's a brain dump about my dad. This is who he was. And just not telling them a story. I just sent them the consciousness of this is who my father was. And the wind kicked up, shifted 90 degrees, and a gust of wind blew the tree over towards me so that it bowed to me. And I know some of you are going to go, nah, that couldn't possibly happen. It did happen. And the woman who came with me so I wouldn't be alone while I was going through this looked up and also said, didn't really happen, did it? But it did. So the interaction of the consciousness of nature and the physicality of nature with your consciousness can sometimes be absolutely amazing. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing, and probably a really good introduction to talking to Peter Shampoo. Peter, thanks so much for being on the show.
It's great to be here, David. Thanks for having me.
And I was so excited to meet you this week. You live a few miles away, and you were kind enough to come by and help me move some heavy objects, and we got to talk, and that was really wonderful. I'm very excited that we finally, after all these years, got to meet.
Yeah, you're at a nice spot. I think you're going to have a good life there.
I appreciate all the insight that you gave me when you were here. So there are two things I ask all my guests. One is, how did you wind up doing what you're doing? And then, what is it that you do? You know, what is the understanding that you bring to the world and the uniqueness? And you've got some very unique work and understanding. So tell us the story. How did you wind up doing all this stuff that has to do with the power of places?
Well, with most fanaticisms, they start young. And it started young with me. I guess my first introduction to stones of and places of power was in Dreamtime. When I was seven, I had a dream seven times of a man on the mountain with a stone circle outside of his front door. Lots of standing stones. At the time, I had never seen such a thing, and it was quite impressive and this great vista. And I just kept having the same dream over and over again. And I think that's really what keyed it into me initially was that dream time. But I was dug up along the Connecticut River Valley with along with dinosaur footprints. My parents built their own home in Holyoke, Massachusetts, where they excavated and dug up dinosaur footprints along with me. And they called me Peter after, you know, in honor of the rock that came out of their foundation. So that name, Rock of the Field, was a key way for me in my early life where, you know, what am I, who am I doing? And well, Rock, Peter Shampoo translates to Rock of the Field. We were a farming family from Canada. So this rock, I started thinking, well, what's a rock in a field? And I came to Stonehenge and the Chard Cathedral, and I started a very intensive self-education in the cultural use of stone. So in this capacity, I studied to be a classical stonemason so that I could build a cathedral if I ever got a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Body held up. And I also studied all the, you know, what went into building a cathedral, all the sacred geometry, and for those who are sacred geometry is simply the geometry that you find in nature. The cathedral builders tried to replicate the geometries of nature, or they did replicate the geometries of nature, to make these cathedrals part of the power of that place. Part of the place, have it grow out of it like a tree, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Geometries are everywhere in nature. So in this pursuit, I kind of got into the next level of things. I was out cutting rock, and I noticed that the way the rock wanted to split was at the same angle as what the cliff side was at, and the cliff side was the same angle as the river drainage that I was in, and there was a mountain configuration with the same angle. So I was seeing this kind of fractal expansion happening with these angles within nature. I knew that nature was full of geometry. You see it in flowers, you see it in the human body, you see it in the trees. Phi proportion everywhere. So I pursued that with a passion and started looking for, you know, I went under the premise that if there's geometry in galaxies, there's geometries in flowers, then there must be geometries implicit to the landscape as well. I was introduced very early on to ley lines in the ancient sites of England. And I said, well, if it is indeed a natural phenomenon, which it appears to be in England, this ley lines that they developed and put standing stones and stone circles along, if it existed in England, it had to exist everywhere in the planet. So I went about looking for such things in the New England landscape and found them as cultural and natural alignments that went some pretty good distances through New England. Now, I was kind of frustrated not having a teacher in it. You know, yeah. When you come up with something new, you know, you got to rely on your own wits. So I started looking for geometries in the land and found a triangulation in Vermont, New Hampshire, between Mount Mansfield, Mount Washington, and Mount Ascutney, which pointed to a center, to a an area to its south, where there was a confluence of rivers. It looked like a vortex in the land. So that generated a whole study called ARCOM, you know, which is ended up becoming the Gaia Matrix, the book I wrote, Gaia Matrix. And the geometry, the geometries of destiny in the North American landscape, available on my website, place.com, also through Amazon, but using my name or Gaia Matrix. And what we did was with that book was describe a kind of a centric geometry that everything pointed to, if you will, like the Mohawk River pointed to it, this triangulation of mountains pointed to it, the coast of Maine pointed to it, the like the Del Mar Peninsula and plain of all those peninsulas, they pointed to it, this Manhattan Island even pointed to it. So it was like, you know, what is this place? And it's Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, and it ended up being
really.
Yeah, it's the center, the geologic center of the North American tectonic plate, if you will. That's really what it's, the bottom line of it is. You know, what I am is an earthstone reader. In my work as a stonemason, I had to read a stone in order to cut it. I would get a large boulder and I had to cut it into, you know, coins and arches or fireplaces or whatever I was building at the time. And I'd have to read the stone to see where I could get all these pieces out of it. And I just applied the same principles to the earth itself, looking at structural patterns within the earth. And I found that the earth has many structural patterns that suggest geometry, very tight geometries. One beautiful one is the Great Lakes. That a pentagram will fit on over very beautifully and lock into Duluth, Chicago, Detroit, and Niagara Falls in its big circle around the Sault Ste. Marie. So you have these. So I'm starting to see I saw this in New England, but then I started to be able to repeat it everywhere. And it became a science that I call geography, mm-hmm. the study of the living earth. So it seems like that these patterns suggest a pathway for us to go in the future. These are sustainable patterns in that they are based on nature's own patterns, nature's own geometry. And from this geometry, we can read its language, you know, kind of its language, but it's how the land speaks for itself, what it wants or kind of what it's expressing. In this pursuit of these ley lines, I've noticed that ley lines have like a propensity of being on it, like a you know, like all cities on a line or many massacres occur on a line or things of that nature. Or there's a lot of volcanoes on a particular line or, it goes up and down in scale. It's, you know, there's planetary conversation here between the structures of the interior of the earth and the sizing of planets in our solar system. There's this relational conversation that's happening that kind of proves or empowers astrology. Kind of it shows how the planets communicate. I discovered that the Earth, you know, if you cut it in half at the equator, have these rings, these radiant rings that I call Earth rings. And the same proportionate ring you'll find in the center of the sun, and the same proportionate ring you'll find in your own eyeball. So it's this kind of like universal thing that consciousness expresses is this I in the world. This so when I'm finding these earth rings around the planet, and there are based on sizing of the interior of the earth. For instance, the very core of the planet is 1400 miles across, where the outer core is 4000 miles across. And Mars is 4000 miles across, and Pluto is 1400 miles across. So and then the mantle, the size of the mantle is the same size as Venus. So there's this kind of visceral conversation taking place between the planets.
And a repeating pattern of particular sizes.
Exactly. And this interior core, outer core of our planet, is this 1400 mile ring. If you were to project this out to the surface, you would end up with the ring of the North American tectonic plate, of which Shelburne is the center of. So there appears to be a conversation in these earth rings between circle and center.
That's absolutely fascinating, and one that I hadn't heard about at all. But the idea of repeating patterns and repeating geometry, I've heard before, but the idea of the sizes, that's absolutely fascinating.
Yes, I find Venus rings, I find Mercury size rings, Mars rings. It's quite interesting. This relationship is quite quite intense.
Yep. Well, I just wanted to clarify for people, when you mentioned ley lines, which I'm familiar with, that's spelled L-E-Y, so that people can look it up, and the tracking and not monitoring, but the figuring out where they are and mapping them has been done all over the world for the kinds of reasons that you talk about, to figure out which places have particular energy or power, positive or negative. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you about a theory I have about ley lines and ley lines in New England and the area that we live in particular. But just an observation from the work that I do. Peter, tell people your website so they can go find you.
Yeah, sure. It's geometryofplace.com. I also have a YouTube channel, also Geometry of Place. So,
and they can also find you on Facebook.
Facebook, yeah. On my website, I have contact information, and there's a new piece that I just wrote called Antero .pdf, antero.pdf.
And I will look for that, because everything you're talking about is fascinating and relates to my work. And we can pick that up a little bit after the break. And this may be too long an answer, but the term that I've heard kicked around for the rudiments of the kind of stuff you do is geomancy. And so what would you say is what geomancy is, as opposed to the kind of stuff that you do? And
geomancy reads the patterns of the earth. And that's essentially what I do, is read the patterns of the earth. But I'm on a next scale geomancy.
Right. Geomancy on steroids.
Geomancy on steroids, exactly.
Got it. Well, we're going to go to a break, and we will be back shortly, unless, of course, we get taller. And we will be back with my guest, Peter Champeau. I keep saying Champeau because the spelling is C-H-A-M-P-O-U-X, very French. Peter Champeau, who is an expert on the power of place, and we will be back with the Farkas Files in just a minute here on Empower Radio.
Do you get tired of styling your hair every day? And do you want a good hairstyle every day? Hi, I'm Sarah Schuster. I went on a website called inventnow.org, and after that, I decided to invent something too. Something called the Instado. Just imagine, you just put it over your head like a helmet does, and you pick your hairstyle with the buttons on the side. Then you can have instant hairstyle in seconds. People like it. People like Jeff Bart.
I like it.
And people like Kenneth.
It's this helmet thing, and it fits over your head, and it's great.
Thank you, Kenneth. You should go to inventnow.org, and it could help you come up with your own invention. After all, look at me on the radio now.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions, or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg!
Ha-ha! I win! Whoa! Ah!
Sassy! Johnny fell down the well!
I'm wet!
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl! What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold!
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound, health, and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six.
Ow.
Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Peter Shampoo, an expert on the power of place. And just, you know, your work is absolutely fascinating to me. I wanted to ask you a question about my take on ley lines, at least in New England. It seems to me that the ley lines started out as probably game trails because the animals walked on the place that felt the best, and then became footpaths, and then eventually became wagon tracks, and then became streets. And in New England, there's this interesting phenomenon where there's a main street in town, usually called something like Main Street, and all of the important buildings in the town are on the corner of cross streets on that main street. And when I tend to look at, when I do my mapping of the energy of a particular place and I've got an opportunity to look at the center of town, what I find is there's a big ley line running down the middle of that main street, and that usually where the churches and the main public buildings are, there's a ley line crossing and often a vortex. So does that make sense in terms of your experience and
yeah
what you've mapped out?
Yeah, sure. The masons who laid out most of the cities and towns around New England were well-versed in dowsing and the techniques of the Templars. I mean, cathedral building, ley lines, things of that nature. I would think that they would know because they, you know, looking at the engineering that they did, if not followed ley lines, actually created them. And that's what I'm finding, that that ley lines are really a co-creation. They're as much a co-creation as they are part of nature. There are lots of you know, energy conduits that are ley energies that it'll come off of, you know, blind springs and, you know, various earth energy features that we can't really go into tonight. But, you know, it's a huge subject, ley lines. And there are there's a many, as many opinions as there are people that investigate them. But what I do is I try to rely on just the physical manifestations of a ley current, and not as Dow's current. You know, I douse afterwards to find out, you know, the dimensions and such and where it goes to, but and what kind of energies it has, and more, you know, specifics of it. But in total, I look for just a pattern of it, natural and cultural alignment in the land.
Right.
And when you start looking for them, you find them, and you find them in your own lives. We make ley lines in our own lives. We just by incidences that happen in our life, we as mobile megaliths, we go around and ground energies at particular places on the planet that kind of generate a geometry. Families generate geometries together. It's really curious to see. I've come across a series of labyrinths that have created alignments across the land.
So. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I as you're saying this, I wonder the stuff that I do when I live someplace, putting up energetic protection and invoking spirits to be with me and that kind of thing, so that I can do the clearing work that I do, creates an energetic structure. And I never thought of it as, in effect, creating ley lines. A lot of my work is involved in mitigating problems caused by ley lines and vortexes that are created by ley lines. So I know that people can affect what already exists, but I really hadn't thought of it as something that we were co-creating. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's how it developed over time. That, you know, for a prime example, in England, they just noticed that after a while that, hey, all these things are all lined up. Look at, I can see, you know, there's one hill after another, and look at, there's a ford, and somebody put a stone right. circle there, and and it just. I've been working on one across the state of Massachusetts where, you know, six different groups acting independently created a east-west line across the state of Massachusetts that was quite, you know, synergistic in the sense of who these people were, you know, what their activities and intentions, and, you know, they're earth-centered communities. All of them. So
I would think, you know, the one that comes to mind out here is the Sirius community, and they've got all kinds of things that they built there, and in both buildings,
right? Yeah,
buildings, gardens, and ceremonial spaces.
Yeah, it's build it, they will come. There is that that piece. There's a lot of those centers going in. In all over, and they are affecting the energetic body of the planet. It's quite curious to see where spiritual communities are guided to you know, build stuff,
right? And like the cathedrals, at least my observation is many of them are built where there's a lot of stone, usually against ledge or something like that, but tending to be rocky places with lots of trees and lots of water. There's usually some kind of stream or water feature.
So it's all about water. Water is really it. You know, the geometry of water is sacred geometry. The H2O geometric of the bonding angle of 104.5, and it generates all the sacred geometries. There's a pentagram implicit there. There's a heptagram, seven-pointed star implicit. There's the Vesica Pisces implicit. It's quite a thing. And with the Vesica Pisces there, it has all the hexagons and all the other, you know, it's a mother geometry. And water, anything water touches seems to inform it's a geometry on it. It's what generates the geometrics of a flower, of a body, of a tree.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Dr. Emoto's work. You're familiar with his work, I think. He would instantly freeze water and make an extremely thin slice so they could put it under an electron microscope and capture the geometry.
Water is consciousness. It's a consciousness carrier. It produces consciousness. It's kind of like Holy Spirit in my book. It's God. It's being made out in space, out in the Orion Nebula. There are 60 oceans a day being produced by this nebula of water. So water is everywhere out there floating about, and water is inside our Earth as well. About a month ago, the geophysicists found the amount of 400 oceans of water inside the Earth down at the mantle boundary.
Wow.
So that's what that's saying, is that there, you know, the water is trying to get to the surface, and this effort for the water to both get into the surface and rain down on the surface generates geometry. And these are the patterns that I'm picking up on, are these the geometries that are generated by water trying to get up from below, or the geometries of erosion. And it's the stuff from below. It's about 200 miles down, and it's primary water. And the scientists have totally rewritten the whole, you know, comet theory. And now, well, the water came from inside the Earth itself. So the Earth is this living and growing thing. At one time, it was quite a bit smaller than it is now, in my estimation, in many people's estimation of the shrinking Earth and this type of thing. Or the expanding Earth. The Earth used to, you know, if you were to take the Earth now and remove all the oceans, all the continents would fit together in a single ball. All of them being about 3 billion years old, where, you know, all the oceans are just 250 million years old. All the rock underneath the oceans are just that young. So it appears as though that there is this kind of a matrix initializing thing that started to grow. Scientists have talked about there being a supercontinent on one side of the planet at one time, and all the rest of the planet was all water. You know, I mean, that sounds like a flat tire to me. I don't know how that.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like something that would wobble.
But speaking of a wobble, you know, we have the Earth at an ecliptic of 23.5 degrees. Now, when we find ley lines at 23.5 degrees, they have the language of the ecliptic. Right. So, like down in Teotihuacan, down at the Pyramid of the Sun in the Avenue of the Dead, the Avenue of the Dead is 23.5 degrees off north. So, what they were doing down there was interfacing with the polar ecliptic to try to keep the Earth turning as it should, and the same angle is seen in Egyptian, in the Jed ceremony, D-J-E-D, where this pillar, this Jed pillar, is raised to this 23.5 degree angle as a kind of a model of the world tree.
Well, what comes to mind is, you know, the you know, in air quotes, scientific way of looking at all of the seemingly ceremonial and religious things that were done in these cultures, which were very sophisticated scientific cultures, whether you look at Egypt or some of the Central and South American cultures. Since we tend to look at it from a scientific point of view and say, what were they observing and how were they using the information that they observed, it's as likely or more likely, from your perspective and certainly mine, that they took the understanding they were getting from their observations and said, we are responsible for keeping this working correctly. And we're building technology that was designed to keep it all working the way it's supposed to be working and not go have it go in some other disastrous way.
There's this thing called syncretism, where one culture comes in and builds on top of an existing one. And that's mm-hmm. what happened in Europe. That's what happened in the Americas. And to a great extent is that, you know, we had a sacred site and, okay, let's put a Christian sacred site on top of that.
And, right. Well, and the same thing happened in terms of dates. We have a holiday or a sacred ceremony that happens on this date in this culture, and we now want the people to be our religion, so we're going to put our holiday on the day that they already celebrate.
Right, right. You know, the sites that were dedicated to the goddess were then dedicated to Mary or Magdalene or someone,
right.
You know, right. And the feast day of Isis is now the feast day of Mary Magdalene and, you know, things like that. There's a syncretism. It's a way in which one culture absorbs another culture. But it's a new way. It's, you know, like the pagan ways were lost you know, where there were all those sacred sites around there and people were still going there, there was something missing. That's why, you know, the new faith came in and it was embraced. But people had to go to these old places. It's where you feel good. The old
right.
places is where the good energies are and where the sacred energies are. They're the places apart, the places of Manitou. And those are recognized by the people who live and tune into the land and live with the land. They experience it. They, you know, when you're part of nature every day, you witness, where the ant mounds are, where the twisted trees are, where the, animal paths are, and all of this together. Points out what's happening in a land, and it's this full view, that this generalist view that you have to have in order to kind of appreciate this work. In our culture of specialists, it's particularly difficult to get this, you know, because it's so broad. It's particularly difficult for me to keep it straight, believe me.
Right. But we also, you know, the movement in the Industrial Revolution and science has been how to use something that you discover, either to create a new technology, but basically for commercial purposes. You know, how can we make some money by what we just learned?
Yeah, I can't figure out a way to make money off this. It's kind of wild. You know? I mean, I offer individual studies for people, but, you know, I mean, it takes me a week to
right.
do something, you know, and it's like, wow, you know.
Right.
It's quite expensive. So.
But, you know, the part of the reason that there has been so much environmental destruction and problems created is the lack of sensibility of our connection to nature and how all this stuff is connected.
Exactly.
You know, the people who come to build a house and clear cut a a lot are doing their job, and it's what they do, and they don't have a sensitivity to, they may love trees, but they don't have a sensitivity to the consciousness of the trees. And I'll go past that lot and feel the confusion and the pain and have a conversation with them and settle them down. It's not that they don't know that they're going to die.
Yeah.
They know that's the cycle of nature. It was just very harsh and not conscious.
Well,
and in ancient times, if you were going to cut a tree, you would have a ceremony and talk to the tree. In the same way that if you go hunting, you would talk to the animals and ask them to sacrifice themselves so that you can live, because everybody has to feed on somebody else. So
yeah,
they're
much Native American perspective you're speaking of.
Right. But I think that's true in almost every indigenous culture, in whatever the variation is, that they have a sensibility of their relatedness to the land and to the consciousness of everything that they're working with, and that that's a part of the way they look at things. You know, getting back to
it's harmonious, you have to be harmonious with the land around you, the trees around you. You know, otherwise you got some trouble happening. And
right, and in particular, we're talking about water and Dr. Emoto's work showing that emotions and pollution affect literally the structure of the water, and that's carried through, and it has
and that
an effect.
That emotion gets entrained in the land.
Gets entrained in the land, but also gets entrained in the people who drink the water and anything that's made with the water. So blessing water is one of the things that, he talks about all the time, and there are ceremonies going on all over the world to try and shift the energetic pollution.
Well, here's a problem that we have associated with the ley line in water. There's a massive ley line going across Eurasia, starting at the Nile Delta. It goes through Ashkelon, Jerusalem, Amman, Jordan, Baghdad, Kabul, Islamabad, Lhasa, and Hong Kong. Now, there's this place called Ashkelon right next to Gaza Strip, that has been in a state of war for the past 5,000, 6,000 or so years, maybe even 8,000 years. The first mention of the state of Israel in this particular area called the Canaanites, you know, the land of the Canaanites, was mentioned by these Egyptians who cursed this well, cursed the well of Ashkelon, because cursed the waters of Ashkelon, because they were rebellious and worshipped a monotheistic god, which was outside the Ma'at, outside the order of the universe, and they wanted to put an end to these Canaanites with their human sacrifice to their god Bel, and put this this curse on that land, and it's been a curse that pretty much is played out in what we see. You know, the wording of the curse, the results of it is exactly what we see has been happening there since, you know, since this curse was written. So somehow that water needs to be healed. Dr. Emoto and the kind of the consciousness of all of us together need to, you know, like kind of pump love into that. Into that holy well, you know, and make it whole again, and make that water right, and you know, whew, we got to stop this, because this ley line going across the world. I mean, it's this curse that infected Ashkelon, has infected Jerusalem, and it's infected all these other places along this great ley, this Silk Road ley. And it's heading for China, and it goes through Iran, and you know, it doesn't look good. So,
Well, it makes perfect sense to me, and as you're talking about it, I can see where it goes. But it's fascinating to me that the wording of the disagreement and the anger is basically fundamentalism versus anybody who's different.
Well, that's the problem with monotheism, when you have three religions that all espouse the same God, but the different, you know, I mean, this curse is like a virus in the software of monotheism, but it's embedded through water. So somehow, you know,
That's, yeah, you know, I'm starting to lose the ability to have a train of thought because I'm thinking so much of the implications of the water and the cursing of this well. And we're talking about something that's been going on, theme and variation, for 5,000 years, which is mind-boggling. It's totally mind-boggling to me. I mean, when we think about the history of the area, we think back 2,000 or 3,000 years, but this goes back well past that. As an underlying energetic emotional cause of all the other struggles that went on. And we don't have time. We're running out of time, which always happens with fast, which is great. And, would love to have you back. But this whole idea that this was started with a curse and what curses mean and how practitioners, who have certain abilities can do that kind of thing, especially if they do it in a group and they do it with ceremony and creating a whatever structural stuff they do.
Yeah, it'd be good to go there in person.
Well, that's a whole other story. Peter Shampoo, thank you so much for being on the show. And I hope this is, you know, as Bogart would say, the beginning of a beautiful friendship. We have a lot to talk about, my friend. And I would love to have you on the show again and talk about things that are more specific, like this historic thing about the curse and things. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being on the show. My guest tonight is Peter Shampoo, who's work is about the power of place. And give your website again, Peter.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Thanks for having me, David. I'm at Geometry of Place, geometryofplace.com. Good article. Kind of dense as granite, but it's my latest writing. It's geometryofplace.com/Antero. antero.pdf, and that has a lot of my most recent graphics and writings.
So. Fantastic. And when you look at Peter's geometry and the stuff that he's mapped out, is absolutely amazing stuff, so I encourage you to go look at his site. Again, Peter, thanks so much for being on the show.
You're welcome, David.
So if in all this you got curious about this guy, David, and what I do, you can get more information about that at househealing.com. On the contact tab, you'll find every conceivable technology for getting in touch with me, including my scheduling calendar. I do a 20-minute free assessment of what's going on with your situation with a person or a place, to see whether, you know, how my work could be helpful to you. So please take advantage of that, schedule an appointment, and let's talk. Information about the show can be found, cleverly enough, hiding at thefarkasfiles.com. And the archive to the show is there, years and years. How long have I been doing this? I don't even know. Of interviews with people. You can listen directly from there. You can also find the podcasts on iTunes Podcasts. We're also now on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and probably some others that I don't even know about. So if you have any of those feeds that you go to frequently to listen to music or talk, look for Empower Radio or look for the Farkas Files, and we're probably there. So lots of ways for you to tune in and listen. And listen to the other shows on Empower Radio, because there are some amazing people on this network. Just fascinating folks. So again, thank you so much for listening wherever you are, whenever you are. It's an honor to be part of your life, and I hope that you're enjoying it, the show, and that it's food for thought, that it gets you to do some new things in your life. So for the Farkas Files, this is David Franklin Farkas. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. See you next week. Have a great time.